This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Audible.com. For you, the listeners of Word Balloon, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. To download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon for your free audiobook. In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today we speak with novelist, television host, and writer-producer Brad Meltzer. Brad's here to talk about his new novel, The Inner Circle, which debuts today and is a return to his Beltway-based thrillers with a backdrop of historical truth. We also discuss his new History Channel show, Brad Meltzer's Decoded, which tackles unsolved mysteries of historical fact. On the show, Brad and his team of three investigators have searched for Confederate gold, reopened the debate over the mysterious death of the Louisiana Purchase explorer Meriwether Lewis, searched for hidden messages in the design of the Statue of Liberty, and investigated the possibility of John Wilkes Booth's escape after shooting President Lincoln. It's a great combination of reality show, historical documentary, and an old-fashioned mystery that the audience can absolutely play along with. Later, we talk about Brad's involvement in Dark Horse Comics' Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 8. Brad wrote the penultimate story, which revealed the big bad for Season 8 and set things up for Joss Whedon's finale. Plus, as usual, there are sidebars and tangents that you can only find right here on a typical Word Balloon conversation. Tell us about the new book that is debuting today.
Yeah, The Inner Circle comes out today, 1-11-11, which seems like secret code, and we got to do everything in secret code, but that's just marketing and luck. And basically started a couple years back because I got a phone call from the Department of Homeland Security, and they said to me, can you come help brainstorm different ways that terrorists will attack the United States? And you know, my first thought immediately was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks. But I was honored to do it. It's what they call their Red Cell program. The Red Cell program brings together out-of-the-box thinkers. So they would have me. They brought, like, a director. They had a chemist. And they would give us targets and put us into groups. And I would come up with my crazy idea to blow something up. And then the chemist would say, no, use this chemical. It dissipates less quickly in the air. And then the Secret Service guy would say, here's where the problem in security is. We can go in this way. And we would destroy major cities in a matter of an hour. And it's one of those days where you go home terrified. But what I would do on the lunch breaks, because they fed us, and listen, any Jew around bagels knows that that's the time to not just nosh, but to kibitz, is basically I went back and I would just constantly be talking to the guys I met there, fascinated with their jobs, that they do this all day long. I was also fascinated just by the idea that they were just enlisting civilians, regular people. And I love that idea, right? It's just that you can be tapped one day and go in and brainstorm for the government. And I found out that it wasn't actually the first time it happened. It started back in the Revolutionary War when George Washington was so sick and tired of the British kind of pulling apart and taking all of his information as he was trying to move it among his military members, said, screw this, and said, get me civilians. Get me regular people who no one will look twice at, and let's make them my secret spy group. And he literally, you know, and those who read Why the Last Man know, you know, my friend Brian Vaughn, because I called him immediately when I found it, it was called the Culper Ring. And the Culper Ring was this real true spy group that Washington used back during the Revolutionary times. And what I loved about it is they moved stuff in invisible ink. They had secret code names. Actually, Washington's code name was 7-11, which is a horrible code name back then. And I just loved this idea. And then I took it a step further, and I said, you know, I was talking to this buddy from National Security, from the Department of Homeland Security, and I said to him, you know, do you think that the Culper Ring could still exist today, that, you know, how would you use it if it could still exist today? And he said, there was a huge pause in the line, and he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't exist today? And I concisely and immediately said to him, huh? And he said to me, think about it. It was the greatest thing Washington had as a tool during the Revolutionary War. It gave him so much success, why would he ever disband it? And it was just one of those moments where you kind of go cold and you go, I like that idea. And I started working from that. And then, of course, you know, I'm speaking to my friend Brian Vaughn and just making sure I was like, listen, this guy says it could really happen, and, you know, you cool. And he was just really great and gave me even more information And I just threw myself into the Kolpe Ring for 2 years. And so what the Inner Circle really is the modern-day adventures of the Kolpe Ring set in the National Archives, where a young archivist finds out about the existence of it by pulling up an old dictionary that George Washington used to use as a code book. And off the thriller goes, so to speak.
Very cool. And, you know, I guess the OSS was kind of recruited in the same fashion as well, the intelligence group during World War II, where they would really get people that were experts and not trained for intelligence, but were hired because of their specific expertise. Or is this something different? You tell me.
No. That's what the greatest part of the OSS, as far as I'm concerned, and for, you know, the OSS was the precursor to the CIA. It was what the government used when they were, you know, before the CIA was invented. But one of my favorite parts of OSS history is exactly that. They used regular people. During World War II, they actually used Julia Child was a member of the OSS. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg was. Even a catcher for the White Sox was.
Moberg.
And what's awesome is I was actually in the archives doing research for the Inner Circle, and they told me that at the time that OSS records were unsealed a couple years ago, and at the time, historians said that there were 6,000 members who spied, Americans who spied for the OSS. They thought about 6,000 when they did the number. When they actually released the records from the National Archives, instead of 6,000, there were 24,000 Americans.
Wow.
And that's how they found out about Julia Child and, you know, the catcher and all the other stuff. And I just love that. I love that they thought it was a small little group and these guys were everywhere. And you know, no question, cool part of history.
Very cool. So what is it like going through the National Archives and being able to tear through and do this kind of research?
You know, the saddest part of the National Archives is they told me this fact, and they said that the number one question asked of the National Archives today, when the people see the Declaration of Independence, the number one question asked is there really a secret treasure map on the back? And I was just like, and it's just kind of, it's like, I guess it's awesome, but it's just so pathetic too, right? And but here's what is awesome. You know what is on the back of the Declaration of Independence? What's really there? Forget about national treasure and all that. What's really on the back of the Declaration of Independence is a thumbprint, a fingerprint.
Interesting.
And nobody knows who it belongs to. And I was like, that's awesome. That's what I want to know about. But the National Archives is without question, and I lived in D.C. for almost a decade, never went there. Never had an interest. I was just always, you know, whatever, like the other
things. Well, you lived there.
Know about. Right, I lived there, you know. Live in New York, you don't go to the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
But what happened was, is I finally went, and I was like, okay, I got to check this place out. They have the coolest things. It's like the attic of the United States. And they have, you know, the field notebook for the Louisiana Purchase, the map that JFK had on Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. They have, you know, they have the Louisiana Purchase with Bonaparte's signature on it.
Wow.
Right? They have, forget about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They have the files on CIA psychics and remote viewing. That's where it is. The Treaty of Paris, that's where it is. The OSS files, as we talked about, that's where they are. I mean, these guys have the most amazing items you've ever seen. You know, from the broken, unbroken, and some say broken code that John Wilkes Booth had and they found in his hotel room. They have, you know, old guns, old bullets, old everything. I mean, if it was a work product of the government or used in the government by any way, it's in the National Archives. And that's where all, you know, it is becomes this great kind of sock drawer for the country.
And I imagine it filled up a couple notebooks for other ideas for books for you. And also probably episodes of Decoded as well.
Trust me, I was stealing everything I could there. I mean, the coolest part was is I went downstairs, and I use this in the book. There's a scene in Preservation where there's a guy down in Preservation. The best part of the whole thing is, like, I go in downstairs. They're like, oh, you want to see the Preservation Room where they do, like, you know, they have the big, giant trees like that you would see in development rooms from when in old school cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a guy, and he's immaculately dressed, and he's just, like, picture perfect, not a hair out of place. Like, the tag on the back of, on the inside of his shirt is pressed. And this guy's just got it together, and he's like, what would you like to see, Brad? And he pulls out, like, the Constitution and says, would you like to hold a copy? I'm like, hold it. I want to sign it. You know, I mean, and you can look at the Declaration of Independence now. It says, like, John Hancock and then a little Brad Meltzer right below it. But, you know, he was just this amazing guy who was just meticulous. And I actually put him in the book. When you see in the Inner Circle the scene in the Preservation Lab, there's this guy who's meticulous and described exactly like that. And when the National Archives folks read it, they were like, okay, here's the, you know, we have corrections here, and this door is actually pulls out instead of pushes in, and you know, all the things you just want them to catch to make sure you're getting it right. And they said, but the one problem is there's no one in the National Archives who is neat and put together like that preservation guy. Everyone's a schlub here. We're all librarians and archivists, and they're schlubs. And I said, and I wrote back, and I was like, but I met this guy, and I pulled out his business card, and I wrote back to him, and they were like, oh, him. Yes, he dresses like that. And basically I found like the one person in the National Archives, like the one truly anal, well-dressed guy, and I love him, but he's in the book too, so he gets his starring role.
You find these amazing ideas, and I remember you telling at book signings a couple years ago about your participation in the Red Cell program, and just the idea of putting average people together to kind of come up with these troubleshooting scenarios of what is around, what's available. Essentially, that's what these terror cells are, just people that have assimilated and really just kind of come into society. So it is going to be something that they can get literally over the counter versus, hey, do you have any plutonium that we could use right now?
Well, and the other thing is, you know, it's like that scene in Dark Knight, right? When, and I couldn't say anything about it then because I knew about it, but you know that scene in Dark Knight when he puts in, when he puts on, and it's to me the horrible part of the movie, it's when the movie starts to fall apart a little bit in that third act, where he puts on the super rays and he can see through buildings and Batman has supervision and all that nonsense.
Yes.
Like, and I kind of always hated that part because it took away from, to me, the core of the beauty of what they were doing earlier in the movie. But that technology is based on reality. It's not just like, ooh, that'll be cool visual that we can do with graphics. The idea is that the hive mind is not just something on Twitter. It's in reality. And now with cell phones and with everything, I went into one of the top Homeland Security places researching and went to this guy who was just, you know, the cutting edge of technology. And he's like, you know how we find something today? With regular people. He's like, that's our best eyes and ears. And it's why you're seeing the Department of Homeland Security now putting out this huge campaign for if you see something, say something, is they realize that forget about the traffic cameras and the things that are on the streets. If you can enlist the average person, you have eyeballs everywhere. And it's been going on for years. You know, Big Brother's been sitting in your office forever.
Wow.
And it's, you know, again, it's spectacular to me. I just like it on the pure sense where you're really going and tapping someone. And, you know, and I think, you know, that's just a great, amazing idea. How could I not grab it and run with it?
So the Inner Circle is out, and I'm very excited to read it.
It's also, I should tell you, it's the first time I'm launching a character that I'm bringing back. I bring back a character from the Book of Fate, who's, I won't ruin, but you'll see, it's a surprise thing. You don't have to read one to enjoy the other. The Inner Circle's brand new, but I'm going to be launching from there this main character, and I think it really sets up, it allows me to do, you know, listen, whatever, for me, the biggest thing I want to do is not do the thing I did before. Like, I love always trying something that I didn't try, and after 7 books in a row of making a new character and never writing a series, I was like, you know what, I don't want to have to, again, reinvent the wheel every time and say, oh, I need a young guy, and he's got to get in trouble, and then he's got to do this, and then he's got to do that, and then the end. I was like, I've done that 7 times, let's try something different. And by using the National Archives and using this idea of the Culpa Ring that still exists today, it allows me to play with the two things that I love, and that is, you know, history and mysteries. And it just gives me that jumping off point where I feel like I can do the character work I want to do and not do the setup work that after 7 books starts to become repetitive. So it lets me be fresh.
Well, and followers of your books like Elmore Leonard and Robert Parker before you, you know, that's a nice little Easter egg where it's like, hey, I know that dude. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think everyone always thinks the grass is greener. Like, all the guys who write series books will call me and they'll say, hey, man, I see you do non-serious books. How's that every time? So, you know, they're all going. You know, I have one guy who's like number one best-selling author, top of the bestseller list every single year, and called me up and said, if I have to write this character again, I'm going to put a gun in my mouth. And I just was like, wow, I never want to be that guy.
Sure.
Right? I never want to be that guy where I just hate, I'm strapped to this character and I hate him so much. That terrifies me. So I thought, what better way to counter that than to try it?
That's really great. Well, you know, honestly, Brett, when I heard about Decoded, immediately I'm like, this is great. The television show plays to your strengths clearly, and I do want to hear about the genesis, but it would seem, as I was saying about you being in the National Archive, that the books feed into the television series, the series feeds into book ideas, and I'm sure you are coming across all of these things that are only providing you with more ideas for different areas that you hadn't thought of going into before. So that's great.
You know, it's funny. It seems like this is all like, you know, this one big, oh, let's do this all, and we'll, you know, we'll really bring it together. But it was just dumb, blind luck. I mean, I was basically done with the book by the time Dakota came along, and it just happens to be the book where I'm going into the National Archives and looking at America's Secrets. I mean, this could have easily been, could have gotten Dakota when we were doing Book of Lies and we were dealing with Superman,
sure,
right? I mean,
sure.
Nobody would have cared. It just was the dumb luck that, and we can talk about, you know, how Dakota got started, but to me, certainly, by going into the archives and kind of setting up shop there, it gives me what I hoped was a kind of center of the wheel where I can go out on all the different spokes and do the White House, you know, the Inner Circle deals with the White House directly. That's what the book is about. It deals with the White House and the president and the greatest secret of the U.S. presidency that this young archivist finds out about. But then it also allows me, if I want to do the Supreme Court, I can do that. If I want to do Congress, I can do that. Everything stops in the archives at some point. And so, it, you know, how could you not love a place that has all that lost history in it?
What secrets of the White House did you learn that you weren't able to put in the book that, you know, fascinated you?
You know, it's the dumb stuff that I'm never fascinated by, like the, you know, this is how a bill was passed into law. Like, that's boring to me, right? I don't care. You know what I care about? Where's the pen go after the president signs something? Because I know he signs in multiple pens, and they always give it to, like, some kid in the front who's, like, suffering from whatever disease they're signing there.
Right.
Where do the others go? Who gets them?
Right.
How do they decide? I love that crap. I love, like, what ice cream is served in the White House mess. You know? Like, what flavor? Who decides what flavor? Is that the president's favorite flavor? Is it the staff's favorite flavor? You know, for 8 years of the Clinton administration, it was Oreo ice cream. Who decided that?
That's awesome.
You know? That, to me, is the very best stuff, right? I want to know all those details. So I always have the dumbest questions. I always have, like, the things that, you know, I'll get to, like, the main guy who runs this part of the White House, and I'll be like, what time do French fries come out of the mess? Is it always 4 o'clock? And they're just like, do you ever care about shit that is important? And I'm like, no, that's the best stuff. So, you know, I actually got invited to go to have this lunch at the White House, which was, you know, completely ridiculous. I had this breakfast, actually, with Neil Gaiman, which is such a name-droppy, douchey thing to do, but we got all the authors at the D.C. Book Festival got to go and have breakfast there, and we all had breakfast, and it was fun. It was like breakfast, you know, which was basically every author was trying to act cool, and they were all stuffing all the White House napkins with all the logos on it in their pants as much as they could. You know, like every author suddenly had to go to the bathroom and then would come back with giant bulges in their pockets just swiping everything. But then I got to go to this luncheon that was actually in the private residence upstairs, which is where nobody gets to go. Like, there's no Secret Service up there. It is where the president lives, and that's where the Lincoln bedroom is, and that's where all the cool stuff is. And I got to go up there, and one of my favorite details that I put in Inner Circle is that when you go to sit, you know, they don't put you, you know, you got to know where to walk in. You don't want to, like, take the president's seat by accident, right?
Right, right.
They figure out very carefully. There's a huge part of, you know, the usher's office and the social office that's figuring out who sits where. And it's not a game. And one of my favorite things is when you go to the president's private dining room, the family dining room upstairs, there's like this little table. And you know those collar stays that, you know, that hold your shirt straight in the collar? They're like little, they're kind of round on one end and pointed on the other?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine just that made of the finest paper you could ever find on the planet, and then your name calligraphied on it. And then what they do is they set up just like this little rectangle, and they put the collar stays in this fine calligraphy paper with your name on it around the table. And you look at your name, and that's how you know where to sit.
Wow.
You know you're the third collar stay in. Okay, you got the third seat. That's your spot. And you can look, and of course everyone looks and immediately wants to see, am I next to the president? Am I next to the vice president? Where do I, you know, where do I go? And because we're all assholes. And then, of course, like, I was seated next to Barbara Bush, and, you know, she immediately was like, like, I was looking, and just as you sit down, just to double-check and make sure you're safe, there's also kind of your name is engraved there on a little card as well, just
okay,
so you can have it. And I'm about to grab the thing and just slide that in my pocket, because I'm like, shit, I'm stealing everything here. Forget it. And she's like, yes, people always want to steal the cards. And I'm like, oh, those novices, you know? I said, I'm like laughing, and I'm like, and so she caught me totally before I could get my hands on anything. Busted me so badly.
Well, and I see, too, one of the advanced people sent me a press release, and it said, in regards to Red Cell, and actually, now maybe I'm taking this out of context, because I do know for Book of Fate, you did get a chance to hang with, and it, wasn't it the Bushes for your research as an ex-president and what it's
it
like,
was
or
the
was
Bushes,
it both?
And then and then went up to Clinton's office up in Harlem.
Okay,
and got to,
it was Clinton as well. Okay, and that was for that was more for Book of Fate in terms
of Book of Fate. Yeah, what they helped me with in the Inner Circle is when I was working on the development of the Culpa Ring. I called up all the smartest people I could to help me design the modern day Culpa Ring. Right, you're going to design. You're going to say the Culpa Ring still exists. Don't just make the crap up. Talk to the best brains you can. Make it real.
Yeah, who would they pick?
So I went to former President Bush and asked him about it. I went to Bush Sr., the dad, who I know very well and who reads the books. And, listen, when the president whispers something cool in your ear, you listen. Right? I don't care if you're the former president. I don't care how long ago you were the guy. You listen. Shut up. Listen. And he was very helpful, actually, with the Inner Circle in terms of helping me kind of figure things out. And it's not like I get 50 million questions with him. It'll just be one or two, and you just got to be smart about, what you're going to ask. But, they're always the most insightful thing you hear because he has the eye that, 44 people in the whole world have ever had and has that experience and, only a couple that are living now. So it's an amazing resource to kind of lean on if you can lean on it lightly.
Well, and also, and maybe it is because they have the benefit of being out of the office and are comfortable with themselves. Now, anytime I see them speak about issues today, I always feel like they were two of the smartest guys in our lifetime to hold the office. And
well, I think the other thing that Clinton and Bush have is they finally get to live in their own skin, right? I mean,
sure.
if you go for 4 or 8 years where everything you say is quoted out of context, put on the front page of the paper to embarrass and crush you, and then suddenly one day you get to be yourself again. And you know what? You don't give a crap anymore what anyone thinks, and it doesn't matter what your poll numbers are, and nobody gives a shit anymore, and you can live. And I think that that's really freeing. It's why, it's why we have a lot of old, people in the country that can say racist things and we all laugh because they're old. But for those guys, it's like they can say whatever they want and no one's going to crush them for it. And I think, anyone who saw those last episodes of Larry King or saw the interviews with the Bushes lately, they're the funniest old people in America. They're the greatest, right? I mean, they're just like, they say things and you're like, man, that's awesome because there's no fear anymore. And I think that if we can all learn to live our lives without that fear, it would be amazing. I strive for it all the time, trying to be myself as opposed to like what the publisher wants me to be or the TV show wants me to be or anyone wants me to be. And I feel like only in the last couple years, probably since Book of Lies, have I felt like I'm actually being myself as opposed to some bullshit thing where I always got to sit there and smile, which is what the publisher used to say to me every time I would go on something.
Well, and I also look at a guy like George W. Bush, who is still, it's only been 2 years, so he still seems like a guy that just came out of his wedding reception is just like, what the hell was that? I was too busy shaking hands,
I think that's right. I think he's still finding his skin, right?
Yes.
He's still looking and going, wow, I lived in dog years for 8 years of my life, and that aged me, and now he's seeing, the book comes out, but watch in 2 more years what he's like. Don't forget what Clinton, how many years it took for him to find his cool again.
Yeah, but also I think Clinton really does just enjoy everything and always manages to find what's fun about whatever current state he's in. I wasn't there, obviously, during the watch of the 8 years, but it just, I mean, he really was always like, hey, I'll tell you what I'd do if it were me.
But first of all, did you see the Clinton-Obama press conference?
Yes. Yes.
Clinton Obama there is the greatest moment in modern history with two presidents. Is like Obama's like, listen, I'm a little late. I got to go. Michelle's going to make it late. And Clinton says, okay, you go. I'll be right here. Excuses Obama and stays to answer questions as if he's still the president.
Exactly.
I love the balls. That's amazing. but that's a fantastic moment, right?
That's
a great moment that shows you the power of this place and more power to him. Go to it. Clinton also knows how to live it up.
And
in a good way. Like when I was in, and I haven't been in touch with him in a while. But when I was in his office all those years ago, and this is when he had left the White House, but he would be, he was going to see the king of such and such country one day, the queen of such and such country the other day, go to Dublin, eat dinner with Bono, and then go, and it was just like that's the rock star lifestyle. That is how you live.
You're here. Too funny, man. Well, that's great. I really love when you get into what it's like to truly be inside, the day-to-day stuff, and like you said, the little nook and cranny things that you don't normally hear about. That's cool.
Yeah, and to me, that's what, I felt like I'd taken two books away from that. And not because I got tired of Washington or anything else. I just like to explore different things. I was like, you know, I think when my mom passed away, I really wanted to explore that dynamic of father-son and with a dead mother, and it was what I needed to write at that moment, and that's where Book of Lies came from. But I felt like, you know, this was me getting back to those who, you know, read First Counselor, Tenth Justice, or The Zero Game. Like, this was me tackling D.C., and it kind of, I always feel like stepping away from your love is certainly the way to let, you know, the heart grow fonder, and creatively, I never want to be that guy who churns it out, and as we were talking about before, wants to put the gun to his head.
Understood.
I wanted to do something, you know, different and try it, and then come back to what I love.
I also love that short book that you made for your son about all the very, and I can't remember the title right now, but
Heroes for My Son.
Heroes for My Son, absolutely, and all these little biographical sketches of, you know, these amazing, famous, and also average people as well that you put in the book. It was great.
Yeah, you know, but again, that was about. That was the result, and you know, I can say it now, of me just getting more comfortable in my skin and putting myself out there. It's a very personal book, right? If you read that book, you will see my belief system. That's what Heroes for My Son is. It's my belief system in book form. And my own publisher rejected that book and said, yeah, you know, we don't, you know, and we went to them, we were like, listen, you don't have to do this book. We never, you know, I know you have a lot of books where the author comes and says, well, I want to write a children's book now. And then you got to roll your eyes and say, oh, shit, we got to pump this children's book even though we don't think it's worth a crap. So we said, we never want to be those people. Don't feel like you have to accept this book. You can totally reject it. And they're like, okay, we reject it. And I was like, wait, what do you mean? What do you mean you're rejecting it? What, are you kidding me? This is a great book. But the truth was they rejected it. And so we went to a different publisher. And I just said, I want to do this book. I don't care if they don't pay us anything for it. I want to try it. And again, I wouldn't have done that 6 years ago. I would have been too scared to do it because I would have been scared of, you know, one, failing, two, what my publisher thought, three, what everyone else thought, you know, all the things that keep us paralyzed. But I just was like, you know what, I don't care anymore. You know, you got to be yourself and you're going to get your best creative work on it. And I love that people love that book and are buying it as baby gifts or graduation gifts or Father's Day gifts, whatever they buy it for. I love that people are taking to that and get to try something totally different.
I think it's great, man, and I think it's the kind of book you can take with your kid and have a discussion afterwards. Well, let's hear more about this guy, or let's go to the library and read more about this person, you know, and find out what the kid, you know, responds to when, you know, you are looking at these little short biographical sketches and you find these wonderful highlights of what made these people important to you. And yeah, I think that's just a great opportunity to make the kid curious and want to learn more. And, you know, that's what we want for our kids.
Listen, I don't really give a shit what anybody else takes from it. It's for my kid, right? It's for my boys. Like, it's not about famous people, right? I mean, it's about what we're all capable of in our very best days.
Yes.
And that's what I want the book to be. It's not about, like, hey, here's why George Washington's great or Jim Henson's great or Mr. Rogers' great, and they are all great. But it's about that little-known fact you didn't know about, and that reminds you what you can do. And reminds, you know, like, all these people are always treated with such kind of reverence where we go, oh, my gosh, George Washington was so amazing. Really, why was he amazing? Tell me why he was amazing. Because he was first president? That doesn't mean crap to me. That just means he was popular and elected. That doesn't mean you're a great man. It just means you had a good campaign. It means, you know, that doesn't tell you anything about the person. Tell me about the person. And these guys become these demigods. But you should tell me that on, you know, the day that George Washington won the Revolutionary War, that the King of England said, well, what's he going to do now? And someone said to him, well, he's supposed to go home. He's not going to, you know, he could have been the King of America. That's
right.
What George Washington could have been. They would have happily made him the King of America. And they said, wait, you're telling me he's not going to take power? He's going to just go home and see if there's an open election? They said, yeah. And the King of England says, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man on the earth. And that's exactly what George Washington does. You show me what someone gives up, and I'll show you who the man is.
Muhammad Ali, another one, a guy in your book, is same thing.
Yeah, no. I mean, all of them, they all have, you know, and again, Muhammad Ali is not in it because he won a lot of fights or because he sued the government. He's in it because he never apologizes for who he is.
Yep.
And that's a lesson over and over. We all, every single day, act certain ways because of the social situations that we're in and what we're trying to protect. And you know what? Sometimes you have to, right? You can't lose your job and say fuck you to the boss and just hope for the best, right? You can't do that. But there are times where you have to grab your nuts and basically be yourself and let it be out there and say, you know what, I'm not going to apologize for who I am. And I feel like the people that I at least admire the most are the people who are that honest and are, you know, willing to let themselves be who they are. And that's a lesson I feel like I fight with over and over again all the time. And you know what, the moment this interview is done and I can, you know, I'm sure I'll have another one where I'll be a little bit more safe or a little bit more whatever because I'm worried about what everyone's going to think. But I fight it every day, and I hope that every single time I go out there, you know, that's the struggle I fight every day, is just kind of accepting myself for who I am.
Oh, that's all right, Ben, and I appreciate these opportunities. We get the real Brad Meltzer and everything, and you can be as candid as you want, and I'm glad that you take advantage of that. That's very good. And the other thing I like about what I'm seeing so far in Decoded and what I've seen as well in your books when you do touch about some historic things is that you do, as you just said, you get to who the person is, and it is those personal touches about these people that was what always interested me about my favorite history teachers. They got beyond the facts and figures, and I really learned what kind of, you know, weird guy, and now I'm blanking, our first Secretary of State.
You learn nothing. I can tell you right now, you learn nothing from your teacher. Right?
No. One of my favorite teachers, Dr. Stein at Illinois State, teaching us about, and I'm blanking, our first Secretary of State. He's on the 20, around the 10.
You make me go grab a $10 bill?
Yeah, exactly. What's his face? The West Indies bastard as my professor.
You're totally speaking in Spanish, man. I don't know what you're saying. I love you.
That's
love
all right.
You.
No.
You're telling me the West Indies bastard is who you're looking for?
That's who they describe. That's who they describe.
That's my hint. You'd be like the worst contestant on Match Game PM to play with.
Yeah, it's like Felix and Oscar on Match Game on Password on The Odd Couple. He was the guy who Aaron Burr got in the duel with.
Alexander Hamilton.
Thank you, Alexander Hamilton. Oh. Yeah, there you go. So, yes, my teacher would refer to Alexander Hamilton as the West Indies bastard, and we learned why, and why all the other founding fathers.
We're on the $20,000 pyramid, and you say West Indies bastard. Can I tell you, by the way, my favorite story about the $20,000 pyramid?
Please.
Is my old buddy, when I was growing up, his mom got on the pyramid, and I got to stay home from school that day just to watch her be on the pyramid, and it was taped, so we actually knew she lost. But she was on with Shelley Duvall, who played Olive Oil in the Popeye movie, and she was making the rounds, right?
and the Shining.
That was who she was paired with, and I was literally like, come on, Olive Oil, get it! You know, screaming like a maniac at the TV, even though I knew the answer and the result. But I got to stay home from school, so that was pretty much the greatest game show of all time.
Outstanding. Yeah. That's great.
Let's take a moment and break from a conversation to tell you about our sponsor, Audible.com. For you, the listeners of Word Balloon, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And I'll tell you, Brad Meltzer is a great guy to sample at Audible.com. The last 7 Brad Meltzer novels are available as audio downloads. Books like The Book of Fate, which tackles some Freemason mysteries and also gives us a look at what life is like for ex-presidents and the Secret Service men that protect them. There's books like The Tenth Justice that talks about the Supreme Court, The Zero Game. All of these are available at audible.com as audio downloads. And if you take advantage of our deal today, you can get one of those for your first free download. It's great. And by the way, that download stays free whether you, after the 14-day trial, choose to keep the service or not. But we think you're going to keep the service because it's a great one. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon for your free audio book. Take advantage of this great deal and pick up a Brad Meltzer novel today.
All right, we're on TV, so let's switch to Decoded. How did Decoded happen?
Decoded happened simply because one of the heads of the History Channel read my novel, The Book of Fate, and it was the one that had Freemasons in it and had the secret code that Thomas Jefferson used, and basically said we should do a show like this. And they came to me. They had been working on this idea for Decoded a while. They just couldn't really crack it, and they said, we want to do a Freemason thing. And I said to them, you know what, why do a Freemason thing? You know, 50 million people are trying to do Freemason things. It's ridiculous. It's overdone. I said, what if we do this? And I said to them, in 1792, the very first piece of the White House was put down in this elaborate Freemason ceremony. And then within 24 hours, no one knew where it was. And for 200 years, everyone from Harry Truman to Barbara Bush had been looking for it, you know, supposedly, and nobody had found it. And to this day, nobody knew where the first piece of the White House, the cornerstone, really was. And I was like, that's an awesome mystery. And because it was laid there by the Freemasons, you can do the Freemasons, but you can do it, the White House, and you can do it in a way no one's ever seen before.
Yep.
And it really became this collaborative process where, you know, they said, okay, give us more ideas and we'll figure out ways, and you give us your 10 best ideas, we'll give you a crew to help solve them. And that's what Decoded was. It was simply just the stuff that was sitting in my notebooks for years that I've been waiting to put into books, and finally having the resources to go out and really tackle them. So I will say it's been an amazing, amazing opportunity, and one I certainly I still look at it and think it's kind of ridiculous we got to do it, but very thankful we get to do it.
Now, who put together this team? You've got three investigators that go out in the road. And I really, folks, if you haven't seen it yet, I urge you to see it because, and forgive me, Brett, you seem to be the other side of the coin to Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory. And I mean that in the most positive way because your stuff, you know, obviously involves a lot of real history. And I really think people are learning when they watch your show in a very entertaining way. But it is almost treated like that, you know, we got to cut the blue wire before it blows up, which
you know,
I love.
They basically, now listen, and they told me on the first week we were shooting, I think it was even on the first day, the producer said to me, on these shows, when you have less facts, you play more scary music. And I was just like, man, no truer words had ever been spoken, right? Just think about it, right? The show ends with like, and will the Freemasons eat your babies? Nobody knows. Tune in next week, you know? And that's good television, I guess.
Absolutely.
I guess that's what they think good television is. But to me, you know what's scarier than that? The truth. The truth is always scarier than the crap you make up, right? It really is, if you can find the good truth. And I think the problem today is there's so, you know, we all say, oh, we have the internet and we have access to more information than any society in history. But you know what that also means? We have more noise than any society in history. Go put in the word Freemason in Google right now, and you'll find 100,000 pages that come up saying they're trying to do everything from take over the world to steal your car right now.
Yep.
And I can find all the crazy theories I want, but tell me the truth. Tell me where it came from. Tell me why people think that. Tell me what the Freemasons even are. Show me what they look like. Are they people with horns? What's the story? You know, are they really trying to eat our babies? Like, what is happening here? And I would much rather personally watch that than have someone play scary music and tell them, you know, and fearmonger. And so, you know, we've always tried to make Dakota the best we can. And listen, we come, make no mistake, armed with our own scary music.
Yes,
indeed. But we really do try to find facts. And it's amazing. That's the hardest thing to find today is that truth.
And not only the Freemasons, but the Illuminati for the Statue of Liberty episode. I thought it was great. I remembered reading about Lewis and Clark. I forgot that there was this possibility that he didn't kill himself.
Meriwether Lewis from Lewis and Clark is one of Thomas Jefferson's greatest confidants. He sends secret messages in code back and forth to Jefferson where they talk about which people in the army they can trust and which ones they think will split their throats. These guys share secrets you would never share with anybody because, you know, you'll die if people hear that stuff. And then suddenly Meriwether Lewis dies after he's governor of Louisiana and after the Lewis and Clark journey, obviously, dies by suicide. And we wind up on Decoded basically taking the gun and taking that model gun, do modern forensic testing and show what it would be like because Meriwether Lewis supposedly shot himself in the chest and in the head. No one knows which one first, but he had two bullet holes in him. And these old guns aren't like today where you pull the trigger twice. You got to pull the trigger, then you got to reload it. You got to put the gunpowder in. You got to pour it back in. It takes the fastest person anyone can do it today is 12 seconds, and that's the fastest. And you're telling me that this guy firing a caliber bullet that would put a hole in you the size of a can of corn, then reloaded, pour the gunpowder magically in, points the gun back at his head and says, you know, that one didn't hurt enough. Let me do it again. I got the patience. You know, no, and there's no nothing about two guns. There's one gun, one guy. And everyone who watches that episode goes, there's no effing way this is true. It didn't happen. Nobody. I mean, anyone. And if not us, and the information that we do find later in the episode is new. We, you know, that was brand new stuff, and God bless the people who found it. There was amazing research that was done for that. But when you just look at that, people go, that should change history. And since that episode aired, we've had all these people write to us and tell us, you know, I mean, it was overwhelming how many people were like, that is bullshit, and we know it's bullshit, and thank you for putting that out there and telling the truth. And I'm honored that we get to do that. That's amazing.
You've got Buddy Levy, Scott Rowley, and Christine McKinley. They are the three researchers we see on screen. How many more people are, you know, running around with you, scurrying around and everything? You're like M. Or Mr. Waverly back on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. back in the day. You're like the spy master.
No. I totally, that's exactly what I am. I'm 100% that. I'm Q. I'm M. I'm Charlie.
Yeah, you're Charlie.
Actually, in the second episode, they cut all. First of all, I just want to be clear. They cut all my funniest jokes. Like in the second episode, they answer the phone the first time. I'm like, okay, Angels, what are you ready to do today? And they literally cut it so fast. And they're like,
aww.
Team Angels. Like, I'm like, no, I'll call them the Angels. And then I actually called them the Scoobies once, and they were like, that's not funny. No one will get it. I'm like, the right people will get it.
Absolutely.
My friends will get it, and they'll know who the Scoobies are. And they're like, stop, Melcher. You're lucky we let you do the, you know, the stuff we let you get away with. So, and they're actually amazing, and they let me get away with far more than they should. So I appreciate it. But yeah, it's what happens that you don't see on screen is that, you know, it looks like I'm sitting on my ass and they go run around. What I'm actually doing is I'm usually on the phone. Everywhere they go, we talk afterwards and before to kind of digest what was said.
Okay.
And a lot of the people you see are people that I know and that I research with. So those Freemason guys you see in that first episode, those are the guys who helped me research Book of Fate. We're the only third camera crew ever, they said, to go inside the Scottish Rite headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And that's just, they trust me, and they know that we're going to try. You know, we're not there to just exploit and go crazy and, you know, and scream from the rafters that they're all nuts. But that was show people the truth and let people decide. And that's how the show is set up. We're going to give you the facts. We're going to show you all the different things. You can decide. I can't tell. You know, people say, well, why didn't you tell us what the answer was? And I'm like, I can tell you, but then that's completely ridiculous that you would believe me or trust me that this thing can't be figured out. So what I can do is I can give you all the facts, present them to you, show them to you, and you can make the decision, because all history is at this point is, who do you believe?
Yes.
Do you believe this family that says John Wilkes Booth absolutely died that day when he was caught? Or do you believe this family, who's John Wilkes Booth's closest relatives, who say, no, I don't believe it, and it was always a family secret and was always passed down secretly. You want to see what those people say? I do too. And we'll show them to you, and you can decide who you pick. I mean, what does it matter what I think? So what we're talking about in each and every episode is, in between those scenes, I'm on the phone with the crew. We're talking about stuff. I'm always on the phone with the directors and the producers, you know, trying to figure out where do we go, what do we do. What you see is obviously the hard work. I mean, the three stars of the show are the stars, and they really are. And they go and they run around and ask the hard questions. And it's the only reason it's set up like that is because I physically don't have the time to go be in the field running around. I would never be able to write my next book or anything else I want to do. So that was how we structured it, and you know, we've had a fun time doing it, and would love to obviously continue to do it.
Did you have a hand in picking this team, or, you know, how did the
team?
Oh,
yeah, no, they gave us, no, I mean, it has been an amazing creative experience where they, you know, we literally got all the reels of everyone, and you get to spend 10 seconds judging people and rejecting them wholeheartedly. It's like being back in junior high school. It's horrible. You know, and you think it sounds like it's fun, oh, that'll be cool to do. It's like, yeah, watch 10 seconds of someone's life and then just say, nope, they suck. And that's a horrible thing for me to do, but that's what it requires if you want to get through these dozens of new people that you're going through today. And so Buddy, Mac, and Scott were, you know, this long, huge process that we had to do. And it just, you know, it took a long time, but it was great. And I'm very happy that we got who we got. We were really lucky to get them.
It's an interesting combination of reality show and documentary, because you do have to kind of play to what sells today, and I get that, and it works. But it is. It's interesting because, you know, nobody – there was no focus group that said, yeah, let's have, you know, the guy who did Masterpiece Theater for years, Alistair Cook. Whereas now it really is, as you say, it is very telegenic, and you do have to kind of get an idea of who people would, you know, be willing to follow on these adventures and stuff. And I told you this off the phone and in my email. When I saw them all together, I'm like, this is like watching the Book of Fate come to life. Because this really was like watching the crazy lawyer, the journalist, and the former Secret Service guy all get together and like cruise around. And when they were driving around, I'm like, this is right for the book.
I told them you said that. They hate you for that.
Did you really?
No, I did. But here's the thing is, you know, when we were doing the show, the format was one that, you know, not that we're, you know, re-cracking the atom here, but basically it hadn't been tried before. It really was mixing a typical history show, which is, you know, here's the facts by boring white men, and I don't mean History Channel, I mean like any show that deals with history.
Sure.
You know, watch a show on any channel, it's like what I call the boring white men parade.
What?
Right? Where the people in front of a bookcase, and then they cut to them, and they tell you what's happening, and then all the B-roll is like classic images shown in that Ken Burns style where they pull in close on it, and it's awful, and it used to be great, but we've seen it 70,000 times, And it's just, wow, there's nothing new here. So they basically, you know, and our process for doing this was completely collaborative. I mean, we had to figure out, okay, is this a reality show or is it a history show? What are we doing? The end result and what you see in Decoded is obviously a very big mixture of that. It's here's the facts and here's all the things you would usually see, but in a format that hopefully is more, and the reason I like it is because you're engaged. You get to ask the question. You get to be there when the people are asking the question, and you get to react and say, I think that guy's full of crap. I think that woman knows exactly what she's talking about. You're the historian when you watch it. And I kept saying that when the first week aired, they're either going to say, you know, and the hard part of doing something like that is you're either a genius because you changed it, or you when no one watches it, you suck because you changed it. But to me, I'd rather leap off that trapeze and at least try something new than just stick with what's tried and true and do nothing that is at all, you know, testing the limits of anything. Who wants to be a part of that?
And it inspires conversation, I think, as you say. I mean, that's the thing. You watch an episode, and if you watch it with a couple people and stuff, I guarantee you, you're going to be talking for the next 10 to 20 minutes, if not longer, about what you just saw and who's right, who's wrong, and what everybody thinks. So, no, I think it's edutainment. Good combination, man. And that's, because like I said, as opposed to Jesse Ventura, you never know what the government is plotting against you next. You know, no, you're actually learning something, and I'm all for that. So this is good. Now, as we're recording this, I haven't seen this coming week's episode yet, but I guess Confederate Gold, you're looking for Confederate Gold this week.
Yeah, by the time Confederate Gold is this week. I'm going to look up right now. I'll tell you what's airing this
Yeah,
week.
I want to know what we're going to release this you know, on the 11th and everything, so you can tell us what to expect on the 13th.
One of the episodes that we do is we actually do the Culpa Ring.
Oh,
we
great.
The Culpa Ring from the book. So we actually get to do George Washington's secret spy ring that he developed all those years ago. And as opposed to the book where I say, here's what the Culpa Ring is today in the inner circle, and here's what it looks like, we actually go back and show you the invisible ink methods he used and all those questions. And what we also do, especially for one of my things that I'm obsessed with is who 355 is. You know, people know her and say, oh, that's the woman from history who was in, very famously for all of us comic readers, was in Brian K. Vaughan's book, Why the Last Man. Mm-hmm. But she's actually, he didn't just base that out of nowhere. 355 was the secret code and was rumored to be the secret female agent in the Culpa Ring. Now, the reason she got the name is because in the code book of the Culpa Ring, the number 355 is what is code for lady. And so there are half of the history says, well, she's a secret woman and she died on a ship and she saved the country and she's the most brave woman ever. And the other half says it's bullshit. It's just a name in a code book. She didn't really exist. And we really try to get to the bottom of who's 355. Did she exist? How the Culpa Ring work? Does it still exist today? And what's the story that's going on? And how much more can Brad Meltzer plug his friggin' book? So, it's really just a nice, beautiful mix.
No, that's great, though. And, you know, I got to tell you, as a comic book fan, I don't know if you're aware of this, because it's a smaller publisher, Ape Entertainment. There's a guy, Ben Coates, who did a great Revolutionary War book called The Black Coat. And it's kind of... Dude, I think you'd love it, because it's a cross between Francesco Francavilla. That was, like, the first book that he did here in the States. And I think got the notoriety that he started getting the bigger gigs that he's been getting nowadays. But it's a cross between Batman Zorro and put a Batman Zorro like figure during the Revolutionary War. And it's really fun. It's really neat stuff. Yeah, The Black Coat from Ape Entertainment. And I know there's at least one collected trade, so you may want to check that out.
Excellent.
Very cool. And it's Culpa, like Mea Culpa, I'm assuming, like the Latin.
No, Culpa, C-U-L-P-E-R.
Oh, okay.
C-U-L-P-E-R, it's Culper, which was, grew up in Culpeper, and that's where they say the name came from, although the source of that is even doubtful, but that's the problem. When you do too much research, you can kind of, you know, talk yourself out of anything, but it is, the real name was C-U-L-P-E-R. My favorite story, the Culpa Ring, is this one, is that when William Casey took over the CIA, he saw that in front of CIA headquarters was a statue of Nathan Hale, who famously said, you know, I regret, but I have one life to give for my country. Casey said about Nathan Hale, why do we have Nathan Hale's statue in front of here? He's the spy who failed. He got caught. He was captured and killed. Why is that the guy we celebrate? Well, who we should celebrate is the guys in the Culpa Ring.
Sure.
And he's like, though that was the guy who kept his secrets for 150 years. They didn't even know the Culpa Ring existed until they did signature analysis and handwriting analysis, and they said, oh, these are the letters from George Washington. This is who was writing back and forth, and that's how they figured out who was in the Culpa Ring. And they said, that's the guy you celebrate. That's the spy who takes his secret to the grave and for over 100 years. And I just love the idea that, you know, he's out there and nobody knew about it for so long. So the Culpring is definitely one of my clear obsessions.
That's fantastic, Ben. Now, let's jump to comics, and I want to congratulate you on your Buffy story. I thought that was a lot of fun. The I hate the word penultimate, so I'm throwing it out there for that purpose. But the next to last story that you did before they got into to find out really Twilight and the big reveal that it's Angel and everything was fantastic. But you got to play a lot with not only the Buffyverse, but throwing a lot of comic book Easter eggs in your story.
Yeah, you know, and I think if I, you know, anything from that storyline, it was just the generosity of Joss Whedon was amazing. It started because, gosh, I mean, it could have been 4 years ago. I don't even know how long ago it was. And he wrote and said, hey, you want to do one of the stories? And he kind of got all the writers and some of the TV writers and the comic writers were all in this mass email. And he was like, you know, tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. You know, if you like a particular character, you know, and you have a pitch for that character and you want to send Xander to, you know, wherever, to Australia to throw boomerangs, like, if that's the thing, like, let me know and I will figure out how to work it in, which is just great. Rather than saying, this is what you have to do, he lets it really be part of the writer's experience. And I took that as my cue, thinking that everyone else was doing the same thing, that I went back and rather than just writing a storyline about one character, I basically was like, here's how I see the Buffyverse, and here's how I think it should exist, and, you know, here's the things that I thought would work, and won't that be fun? And it was totally complete fanfic, right? It was just like me imagining everything and how I thought that this should go and things. And I sent it to him, and I said, listen, if you think that this is great, let's talk about it. And if you think, you know, you read this and you go, Brad, I really should have never hired you. Goodbye. That's fine, too. I totally get it. And he came back and said, you know, there are things I love in here. There are things I hate in here. But I really like you to write the penultimate arc, and I'll follow you and close it, and let's do this. And it was just so generous in terms of what he was letting me play with his characters that are so well-developed and so well thought out and so defined to that, you know, really fine point. And he really let us have fun with it, and not just because he let him have sex.
Yes, indeed. I'll be honest, I forgot about the fact that you got to write the real hardcore Buffy Angel comic booky sex scene. That's really cool, because I was going to say what I loved about Season 8 in general is that it absolutely takes advantage of the fact that it is in a comic book, and they get to do things that from a budget standpoint they'd never be able to do on the TV show, but also, you know, having Andrew standing there with Captain America's shield and, you know, one of Iron Man's gloves, if it was an Iron Man. Yeah, it was. He had a repulsor.
No, it was Iron Man's glove. Oh, yeah, no, you should,
There you go.
There.
You know, and they're in the danger room, and they're on the bridge of, you know, in one of the rooms of the Enterprise.
We did the friggin' machine from the X-Men Teen Titans crossover, right? I mean, there was no more geeky reference that could be made. Like, when I put it in, I was like, Josh, if you don't like this, let me know. This is as geeky as I'm going to get. And he was like, love it. And I'm like, awesome. Like, just, I mean, the fact that we got to put that in, and George, when I got that sheet of paper that came through that JPEG, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, there's the machine from from Teen Titans X-Men crossovers, like, which also has, by the way, the greatest handshake of all comics, which is, you know, except for when Muhammad Ali shakes Superman's hands at the end of Superman vs. Muhammad Ali, is when Robin and Cyclops get to shake hands, and you're waiting for the fight, and you turn the page, and they're shaking hands, and I love that.
See, I have to confess, not being that big of a Titans or X-Men fan, never bought the Treasury edition of that.
Dead to me. You're totally dead.
All right, wait, back to the sex, though, of Buffy and Angel. Was there any pressure knowing that you're writing this scene that, you know, even in the TV series, we only saw before and after, so now we're finally getting to see some, you know, comic book-style sex?
And again, full credit here. I mean, you know, Joss and I talked about it. We knew it was going to be, this issue where we were going to deal with it, and you know, we talked about it, and we were like, you know, we already saw the, ooh, let's show before, and then, ooh, we'll show the panties on the ground and smoking a cigarette in bed. Or, ooh, you know, and you kind of had seen it all before, and both of us were going, you know, let's do some different way. And I kept saying, you know, we saw that one before, we saw that. And then Joss just blurts out, and he says, you know what, we show it. I'm like, what? And he's like, we're going to show it. The whole issue, we're going to show it. And I was like, okay. And then I realized that I'm the one who's getting fucked here, not Buffy, because I'm the one who has to now deal with this and figure out, you know, how do you show, you know, and, you know, listen, I don't want to do something where it's going to be in poor taste or, you know, be exploitive or any of those things that there are huge traps when you say you're going to show it. But to me, again, why do it if you're not going to challenge yourself and try what you can't do otherwise and what no one's tried before? You know, we've all seen Superman and Wonder Woman with the cape around them up in the clouds and they're supposedly having sex. And that's about as titillated as nothing, you know? And, you know, the idea was to really do something that, you know, would further the story, make it work, fit in thematically with what we were doing.
Right.
And not fall into the traps that are so easily all over a scene like that. But full credit to him for saying, you know what, let's try. You know, we may fail, but let's try. And that is what all I ever want to be about creatively.
When he first proposed you coming on as one of the writers, did he kind of lay out the whole season and say, this is what's going on, Angel is the big bad? Or, you know, how much were you told about the overall story to get you to be able to write the portion that you're able to write?
You know what? He told us Angel was the big bad. He said, Angel's the big bad. That's where it's going to come from. And then the truth was that it was so, in the very earliest stages, he said, you know, he told some other parts, which I don't, you know, I'm not going to say because obviously it's still going and finishing, but we knew Angel was a big bad, but we really didn't know much of the between. You know, it was like, you know the beginning, you know the ultimate end, what's in between? And that's when I said, you know, what if we come up with, you know, how the Buffyverse works? What if the universe does have a plan? What if, you know, those things that I really wanted, I felt like, you know, I remember writing and saying, you know, if the universe is smart enough to make slayers when there are vampires, you know, how is it not smart enough to also try and figure out that there's a plan for them too? You know, that this is just how the ecosystem works. You know, it feeds itself for a purpose. It's not just for no reason. There's a grand plan here. It's not just, oh, we got to kill the vampires, so let's have slayers, and that'll be the end. You know, that's a pretty smart friggin' universe that's talking right there. So how can it not be smarter than that?
Really interesting. And, you know, and obviously you're a big fan of Andrew and Warren and those guys too, and throwing them in.
You know, the funny part was is I actually didn't think I was going to use Andrew at all. I really didn't. I was like, you know what? I don't need it. I can do the comedy with Xander. It's going to be better. But when, you know, this is where, as you're going through the beginning of the book and you're reading things, you know, Xander took on a much more adult role in all of season 8. And I can come in and ram my way of doing Xander down that throat, but it's not going to be true or fair or honest. And I just said, you know what, it was clearly Andrew who was filling that role. And I will say, and I saw someone else, I forget, one of the Buffy writers also said it, and it's just so true. I started writing him, and I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop him. He just took over every scene he was in. He was barely supposed to be in that first issue I did, and he wound up, you know, to me being the star of the show. And it was because, one, you could do the funny, but what was more important is, you know, if we're playing with the tropes of a comic book, and the first issue was all about playing with what a comic book is and what it means to have superpowers.
Yes.
Andrew was just the perfect man to go to for that. And he, again, it was a credit to Joss, like, just shows you where, you know, when you have a good character, the writer doesn't have to write him. You kind of just channel him.
And you did all those kind of homages to, like, Action Comics and stuff, where Xander is testing Buffy's strength abilities and stuff. That was a blast. That was hilarious. Very funny.
Trust me, that was the only page of art. George just said to me, you can have one page of art, pick what you want. So gracious, so nice. And the one I picked was her holding that train above her head like Action Comics, the Stronger Than a Locomotive. I just love that splash.
No, it was outstanding, man. I've loved season 8. I wish it was a little shorter. But I do think that there are a lot of amazing arcs. Yours is one of them, and that's great that you were able to be a part of it. And if there are plans for season 9, I hope that you're able to find time in your schedule to contribute more. I don't know if it's in you. Would you like to write more Buffy if you had the opportunity?
You know, I love that character and would have fun with it. For me, it's purely a function of just trying to find time to do everything I want to do.
Understood.
And that is nothing more than that, but I had just a blast doing it. It was great.
Now, your other comic book writing, you know, has had such a big impact on the DC universe. And, you know, I don't need you to go into detail, but I'm sure we're all wondering if there are plans for 2011 that might involve you.
You know what? There are no plans as of yet. I mean, I've just been so focused on trying to get Decoded done and get the Inner Circle out, and those two things kind of both happened at the same time. But hopefully, you know, when that is all said and done, we'll figure out, you know, because everyone who knows me knows I just love doing comics and can't keep me away for that long.
Yeah, so I guess Decoded has kind of taken the place of the brain scrub that you've always described in terms of what you've done in between novels. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, I mean, that, you know me well. I mean, that every novel I kind of take a break between and then do a different project. And Heroes for My Son was kind of the last one, and usually I'll do a comic book. But Decoded really did fill that spot this time. It just did, and you know, I can't say I regret it or trade it or wish I did otherwise. It's just, you know, that opportunity opened, and I felt like I had to try it. You know, the last time we did TV with Jack and Bobby, and we had a total of, you know, when they gave us our ratings, they're like, okay, the ratings are, we're like, what are they? A four? I'm like, oh, a four share? They're like, no, four people watched the show. And it was like, and they're all named Meltzer, and they all live in Florida, and they're all old Jews living in Florida. You have four viewers. So I was just kind of determined to try again.
But I've been happy to see on Comcast, at least by me, that they've put Jack and Bobby up there on their WB channel. So I hope that people have reached back and been able to watch some episodes of Jack and Bobby. Because it was never a question of quality, Brad.
No, listen, I don't ever think it was a question of quality, because that would mean admitting that I did something wrong and I can't possibly do that. But the truth was, is, you know, Jack and Bobby, I love that we got to tell our whole story. You know, we were, when Jack and Bobby was sold, we had offers from ABC, Fox, CBS, and what was then the WB. We had offers from every single place but NBC. Had the same offer, same money, same everything. Okay, there was no one who had anything better. They all had, like, reached that one point, and they said, and the agent came to us and said, well, where do you want the show to be? And we said, well, where do you think it's going to have its best shot? Creatively, where are we going to be? You know, everyone was amazing. We had Gail Berman at Fox. We had amazing people who now I work with on Decoded.
Yes.
And Nina Tasser at CBS, amazing person. Like, these, we couldn't go wrong. But my agent said to me, I know that being on CBS or being on ABC is going to impress your friends more and impress your family more, and you'll get to say, oh, I'm on big network television. But I'm telling you right now, if you go on that network, on any of the big networks, and you have bad ratings, you will be dead in three episodes.
Yep.
But if you go on the WB and you have bad ratings, they'll at least give you a season, and you'll at least be able to tell your story. And it was that moment where you're faced with what your ego says versus what creatively you think. And I could easily have chosen my ego, and we could have said, yeah, let's go on the bigger network, let's go for the big splash. But instead we said we'd rather have the creative control and the ability to tell our story. That was more important to us than impressing people. And so we did, and you know what? We got to tell our story, and everyone that worked on that show was amazing. I mean, look who we had on that show, right? Is forget about, you know, the writers of it. You know, Michael Green and Mark Guggenheim, who you know from comics.
Yes.
Now, Greg Berlanti. I mean, all these guys are writing the Green Lantern movies and all the other things that they're working on. We have, you know, and the stars of the show. I mean, half the cast is on Mad Men now. You know, I saw John Slattery last week, and we were just talking about, you know, they got Matt, you know, Matt Long, who's on Mad Men now, Jessica, who's on Mad Men now, is his wife. I mean, it's just this
wow.
amazing group. And Logan Lerman, who was our Bobby, who was up for Spider-Man and is in, you know, just doing incredibly well in the Percy Jackson movies. And I just feel like, and Bradley Cooper, people forget, was like, he was the co-star, right? He was Grace's boyfriend. It was Bradley Cooper. It's like, we had the best casting agent of all time on Jack and Bobby.
No kidding.
And, you know, and we got to tell 22 episodes of that. That's now available free to anyone on demand or on the, you know, the website. I mean, it's, which I love. So, you know, you can't ask for, or bitch about more than that, for more than that.
That's really cool. And, you know, all right, now this inspires another question, because the way dramatic television is today, I mean, you've just expressed the concern I think a lot of people that come with dramatic ideas have, whether it's going to be, hey, the network wants it, or even better, basic cable wants it because they're guaranteed that season versus the dice that you throw with dramatic television. I mean, good shows get killed all Southland, great that TNT was able to pick it up. NBC didn't know what to do with it. Glad TNT knows what to do with it. So
listen, that's why you're saying, that's why everyone's saying it's the golden age of television, is cable is allowing that creative play that a network can't afford. I mean, here's what people don't realize. When they have a, you know, and we learned this on Jack and Bobby, is on Jack, when we were on with Jack and Bobby, they sat us down and they said, listen, if we don't pull in the ratings numbers, we don't get the amount of people that we want, we have to pay the advertisers back. We have to give back the money and pay them for the amount of people that we promised them. So So if we can put on a rerun of Charmed and it beats Jack and Bobby, like, no offense, but we got to do it. Because,
sure.
And it's not about having creative balls or, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the suits are just, they're not willing to take chances. It's like, no, you can't put a gun in your head. Like, you literally would have to pay back the money. So it's not just about, yes, it's about creativity, but not just about creativity. It is a business at the end of the day, and these people are on the hook to major companies, and that advertising is why you get to see what you see. And I hate that fact, and it's why cable gets to get away with it a little more, because they don't have to make those promises as big. But that's what runs television at the end of the day.
That's the reality, right.
Now, I wish it weren't true, but it just is.
Does that curtail thoughts of dramatic ideas? I mean, do you still have ideas? I know that you've mentioned a couple in past interviews that you've thought about.
Yeah, listen, we sold one last year. We sold a thing, we sold this show called The Romeos, which was basically a band. They're like the Beatles. They're going to be the biggest band in the world. But right now, they were just 21-year-old kids.
Right.
And it was called The Romeos. We had the guy from Avenue Q did the music, and we went out, and we sold it to ABC, and we wrote our pilot. And then basically they were like, yeah, the problem is this other show that's also a musical, and people are probably only willing to put on one musical this year, and that show happened to be Glee. We were the other musical show competing against Glee. So, and to be fair to Glee, their pilot was far better than ours was. It was
okay.
Better written. It was better done. It just was. I can tell you that. And I was one of the creators of the Romeos, and I can tell you theirs was better, and it should have been on more than ours. But it was interesting that they were like, yeah, they're probably only going to put on one musical this year. And I was like, well, who are those losers? And they're like, it's called Glee. And I was like, well, what's this thing, Glee? And then Glee, and we're the dumb schmuck sitting at home. So I'd love to do it again, but we have to just, again, find the right project, not just do it just for the sake of doing it.
Fair enough, man. Well, all right, I know we're up against the clock, so I'll wrap things up. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
No, man, I appreciate it as always, and let me end by just saying the most important thing of all, and that is just to say thank you to every single person who supports all these different ridiculous things that we keep trying and trying hard not to fail at, whether it's, the new novel or the TV show or the comics or anything else. It means the world to me.
Any comics you're reading currently that you want to throw out there?
I finished it a while ago, but I still love it. I still think Pluto, the manga series, and I hate manga. I never really like anything I read there, but Pluto is just the one that blew me away. It is just as good as anything I've read in a long, long time, so I keep shoving that one. And I was last man on board with Brubaker's Criminal series.
Oh, Criminal.
I did that, and I was like, I just loved it, and it just blew me away. But I was last man on the bandwagon for it.
No problem, man. Well, good luck with The Inner Circle. It's out this week. Decoded is on Thursday nights at 10 Eastern, 9 Central on the History Channel. Brad Meltzer's Decoded. It's got Brad's name right at the top.
Yeah, it's a title or else we sue. and if anyone wants to see the book tour, is on bradmeltzer.com. If you go under appearances, there's like a 12-city book tour. So I'm going. If you live in a major city, I'll probably be there in the next 2 weeks. So
you coming to Chicago?
I will be in Chicago on the last week of the tour.
Outstanding. I will see you there. And it's a pleasure as always, man. And good luck with everything. And also, by the way, I have to give you a little nudge about that you're on before Ancient Aliens. And I'm glad to see.
Trust me, I'm well aware. My wife tells me every single time.
Nice to see
you. My wife suddenly has become like a studio executive. She's like, I've looked at their demos, and I don't think they're real. And I'm like, will you stop? Everybody calm down.
Is everything going good? I mean, we're a month in. Has the response been good?
Yeah, we've been thrilled, really, really thrilled with the ratings and just, beyond what we thought we were going to get and feel very lucky. To me, I'll believe everything when I see it, and we're just going to have fun with it to the end and see what happens. Well, at this point, we all know it is out of our control.
Understood, but it's been a great 4 episodes that I've seen so far. Best of luck for the next 6, and hoping that this is not the only season of Brad Meltzer's Decoded, because it's a lot of fun.
I appreciate it, pal.
That's Brad Meltzer. Again, make sure you check out Brad Meltzer's Decoded. It's on Thursday nights at 9 p.m., 10 p.m. Eastern on the History Channel. And don't forget to pick up his latest novel, The Inner Circle, which is out in stores today. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. Word Balloon today was brought to you by Audible.com. For you, the listeners of Word Balloon, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their great service. For all the details and to download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/wordballoon for your your free audio book. Do yourself a favor, take advantage, and get one of Brad Meltzer's great audio books. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. Every Tuesday, you'll find us at ifanboy.com and, of course, our website, wordballoon.com, where we have our archive of well over 300 interviews with great pop culture guests. Any questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can follow me on Twitter under John Wordballoon, or, of course, on Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2011.